Hey, seemingly unrelated fans, welcome back to the show. You may have noticed in the last episode and in the description of this episode, we've had some guest co-hosts on the show. Just letting you know that Jason is moving on to his own creative projects. He's cooking up something really good in the lab for all of you to enjoy. We really want to thank him for all the time and the passion and the contributions he made throughout the show. They've been really important, valuable. We really appreciated all of that. So we do want to wish him the best of luck on his new... I don't want to spoil it. I know a little bit behind the scenes, but I don't want to spoil it for anyone. If you want to get all the updates on that and be there day one when it drops, you can follow him on Instagram, Jason Howard Heat. That is Jason, J-A-S-O-N, Howard, H-O-W-A-R-D, Heat, H-E-A-T, where he will definitely be announcing that for you. Let us know about the guests if you like any of them, but we'll be continuing with guests at least through season two, and we'll update you before we head into season three. Now, on to the rest of the show.
How did two inbred hamsters save countless lives during the Second World War? Well, there's only one place to find out, and that's right here, seemingly unrelated. Welcome back to a Seemingly Unrelated, the podcast where we connect the seemingly mundane elements of everyday life to the most unbelievable but true stories and events across history, society, and culture. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Johnstone, lecturer, culture, media, and society at the University of Glasgow, and joined, as always, by my stalwart producer, Naomi. Say hello, Naomi.
Hello, everyone. Lovely to see you back. Or hear you back, for you to hear us back.
Or holla back. And our guest on this episode is the Associate Director of the Black Communication and Technology Lab, Assistant Professor of Communication at the University of Maryland, co-author of her latest book, Techno-Skepticism, Between Possibility and Refusal. It is... Rihanna Walcott. Hey, Rhee, how are you?
Hello, hello. I'm well. Thank you so much for having me.
Please, could you just fill in the listener? Because they're not as familiar with you as I am. They're not as enlightened as I am on this particular topic. What? Tell us a little bit about techno-skepticism.
So techno-skepticism's this massively multi-authored monograph written together by the DISCO Network, which stands for Digital Inquiry, Speculation, Collaboration, and Optimism Network. And our logo's a disco ball. It's great. And we wrote this book together that talked about our relationship to technology and that being somewhere in between optimism and refusal of it. So like we have a skeptical look towards a lot of the ways that tech is embedded into our everyday life and a lot of the sort of movement of like new development of certain tech. So it's broken up into three parts and we all wrote it all together over a week, which was really chaotic, but co-authorship from hell, but it's ended up being something great. So the first bit thinks about diagnosis and wellness and digital diagnosis and particularly thinking about how, you know, people of color, differently abled, and also like other marginalized people who have differing access to tech, engage with like healthcare, diagnosis, how deprivation leads to like differing outcomes, and how we create community access to technology, the opportunities that like the internet can provide in terms of us having access to information and healthcare.
We're going to put a link in the show notes to techno-skepticism so that if anyone heard that and thought yes, then you can just go to the show notes of this episode, click, and then you can pick it up. So good to have you. Rhee, we're going to start off with a simple question. Have you ever had a pet hamster before?
Yes. actually.
Tell me about your pet hamster, please.
Okay, well, it was actually my little sister's pet hamster. And he was a small, very small Russian dwarf hamster. And I insisted on naming him. I think I was in like year 8 or 9 at the time, because at school I was studying Russian. But I did insist on naming the hamster, and I managed to convince Maya to name him Rasputin. Because I told her, like, oh no, he's a prince. Don't worry, Maya, he's a prince. And yeah, so that was him. That was Rasputin the hamster. He's a good hamster.
Russian dwarf hamster named Rasputin. Uh-huh. But Rasputin wasn't a prince. He was just a charlatan.
I know. That's how I lied. You see,
oh, you lied. You just lied to your sister. Cool.
I lied to my younger... That's the point of the story, that I lied to a child. Yeah.
Did she know this?
She knows it now.
Well, by
the time she was like 9, so maybe less, 8.
What a way to find out. Yeah, hamsters as pets is a strangely recent phenomenon. They actually have not been pets for a very long time. So let's take a little second, give ourselves some background on the hamster, just to get settled in. So Ree, you had a Russian dwarf hamster. There are 3 different types of dwarf hamsters: the Russian one, there's like a European one, and then there's a Chinese dwarf hamster. But the most common pet hamster is the golden hamster, also known as the Syrian hamster, for reasons we will get to later.
I actually owned a Syrian hamster like a year ago.
Wow.
I was a very late adopter to a hamster, and it was called Pesto. She was a Syrian hamster, and she was massive.
Yes.
Like a lot bigger than the dwarf ones. Yeah.
Yes. That is the big difference. The dwarf hamsters are... they're dwarf hamsters. It's in that. Although I don't know if we should be using the term dwarf hamster, but whatever. It's not up to me. This is what all the resources say. I'm going to go with them. But yes, the golden hamster, the Syrian hamster, is like 3 times as large as most of the Russian or Chinese dwarf hamsters. They're very big. And they are crepuscular in the wild. If you have any idea what that means. It means they forage for food in the twilight hours, but they tend to shift into nocturnal behaviors when in captivity. So,
yes, I remember that.
Yep. All your memories of a hamster being up at like 2 a.m. running on its little wheel and like rifling through things, that's because when in captivity, they can't tell that if it's twilight or not. So they don't know if they're supposed to be foraging for food. So they just kind of, their whole biology gets thrown out of whack. They've mostly been around for about 10 million years. The word hamster is an Iranian word. It's a Persian word. And it means one who tramples down. Yes, they are the tramplers. As hamster owners, does that seem like an experience? Do you think of hamsters as trampling anything?
That is not what I thought of, no.
See, I put mine in, like, I did all this crazy research. This is why I got into it. I went into, like, a special interest of just looking into hamster YouTube videos for about a year. And I said, I have to buy one. And I gave it, like, 2 feet of, a feet of, like, bedding. And then it, like, made loads of burrows and things.
Aww.
So I guess it tramples down, like,
tissue
in
paper.
The fact it makes, like, it makes, like, a burrow.
Exactly. It does. It burrows. I do want to note, Naomi, for your A-levels and university projects, you would not read the source that you were assigned. You would merely pull quotes from it. But when it came to getting your hamster's habitat...
Oh, yeah. A year of research. I built it from IKEA tabletops. Yeah. That.
But you built your own hamster habitat.
A hamster run.
It was like a full-on massive kit, because people don't realize that you're not meant to keep them in small cages. So people think hamsters climb. Hamsters don't naturally climb. They actually want to burrow, but they just don't have enough bedding to do it. I've got weird about hamsters.
Now.
No, I spent a weird game. I got weird.
You were
about hamsters.
A child. I wouldn't worry about it.
I have a question based on some of this burrowing comment, like, so, and the nocturnal bit. If you had a we play with them in the daytime because we are not nocturnal. Was that like incredibly cruel to my hamster?
They didn't love it. That's if they ever, if you ever, by the way, if your hamster ever bit you or just like wanted to get away from you, yeah, because basically you were waking up in the middle of its sleep cycle and being like, hey, let's have a fun time. And hamster's like, what's happening?
Damn.
You're going to leave this podcast with a lot of guilt. That's how we like to treat people when they come guests.
Good. Yeah, it seems the hamster as a pet, like Naomi said, you don't want to put it in a cage and you don't want it to hang out with other hamsters. It is a solitary creature that wants to burrow. That's the short and long. So like the fact that we make them into pets is quite strange, right? Like they sleep when we're awake. And they're quite violent. So the path towards becoming a beloved pet, because they are adorable. I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10. I got distracted 7, 8, maybe 9 times over the course of doing the research for this episode. Because I was like, oh, look at these hamsters. They're so cute.
So cute them. And small. Yeah.
So like, how did we end up with the hamster in our home in the cage? Which brings me to my next question, Ree. Have you ever had any parasites in your life, whether internal or otherwise?
What, like on like myself? Like, yeah. Have I ever had yeah. a parasite?
Have you ever had a parasite?
No. I'm gonna say no. I feel like you'd know. You would you'd remember that. Like they're probably horrible.
So the story of the pet hamster begins, oddly enough, with a parasite. That's cutaneous leishmaniasis. I hope I'm saying maniasis correctly because I'm going to say it 9,000 times. Cutaneous leishmaniasis is a parasite that spreads to humans by sandfly bites. And it is cutaneous, meaning it affects the skin. Because it causes a lot of formation of lesions. So if you had leishmaniasis, you would know. All these horrible sucking wounds. It's really gross. Very, very unfortunate. It's super easy to prevent because it's sandfly bites, just like malaria, sleep with a mosquito net because sandflies are largely nocturnal. And this disease, this human interaction has actually been around for like, it's one of the oldest diseases in human history. It's been around for 4,000 years, mostly in the border regions of Iran, Iraq, Kurdistan, and Syria. Now, when you hear that Iran, Iraq, Kurdistan, Syria, as well as the Democratic Republic of Congo and Belize are all major sites of the outbreak of this parasite in the last 100 years, Ree, what do you think is a great way to determine whether or not there's going to be an outbreak? What are some signs that maybe the DRC, Belize, Syria, Kurdistan, Iraq, and Iran all have in common in the last 25 years?
Perhaps, in the last 25 years?
Mm-hmm.
Bit of unrest, a lot of sandflies. I guess.
Yeah. It's a lot of unrest. Yes. The number one way to determine if there's going to be an outbreak of leishmaniasis is refugees. If there are refugees, there is an extreme increase in the outbreak of this parasite.
Is it a person-to-person transmitted as well?
No. It's only the bites of the sandflies. But because, again, any kind of netting or just sleeping in a bed that's not on the floor means you pretty much don't get it. It ends up being a disease of deprivation. Also, mm-hmm. a lot of humans will get bit by the sandfly and the parasite won't even get to take root because they're healthy. Whereas if you're experiencing malnutrition or exposure, weakened immune system, the whole thing, causes an issue. So anywhere where it's hot and there's a lot of refugees, you will find sandflies spreading leishmaniasis. I'm interested in your thoughts on this, Ree. in 2025, you have done a lot of looking into health as a cultural system. What do you think about this disease of deprivation? Why aren't all diseases technically diseases of deprivation?
It's funny that you say this. That is exactly the framing in a book that I just reread. Oh my God, wait, hang on. It's called...
Grabbing the book off the shelf.
There we go. Yeah, it's called No Such Thing as Normal. Disorders, Diagnoses, and the Limits of Psychiatry by Marieke Bigge. Basically, her whole framing is thinking about the limits of psychiatry as a discipline and why we need to start thinking about deprivation as like a... as an important actor in how we talk about, in this case, mental ill health, but she also touches on the history of like hysteria and, you know, all of these sorts of things where how can I talk about a normal or like a baseline of like what health is without first of all factoring in like some of the different like cultural attitudes and access to the discussion. So yeah, absolutely. Like, how can we talk about this without thinking about who has access to a bed above ground?
Yeah, right? Isn't that what a wild concept to just think that, like, if you have a four-post bed, you survive, and if you don't, you get a parasite.
I ran a project for cancer research. It was training, like, Iranian refugee ladies on how to go get their screenings done. And it was so interesting because I realized, like, they can't even talk to the doctor. So they can't speak English. A lot of the information I taught them, I'd be like telling them something, translating it and everything. And I'd be like, do you understand? They're like, I'm telling them phones don't cause cancer. And then they go, yes, I understand. Phones cause cancer. And right. then I'm like, okay, they can't even understand the concept of how to get a check done because they don't understand me explaining it to them. So they're going to be the people that are most vulnerable to finding out later stages that they have cancer. So yeah, it's so interesting. The access is such a big part of it. The inequality is there.
And if you can imagine, like, what if, and I know this would never happen, the world were hit with some sort of a pandemic that was a respiratory disease specifically. Imagine.
Fancy that. And then also even just the way that we talk about protecting our, you know, more marginalized people in society, it's crazy to think that people would maybe say that, oh, it will just get the elderly. It will just get the weak. It will just get, right. And like, who cares about them?
a truly mad, the my favorite was like, whatever, it's just old people and fat people, who cares? Like,
oh wow, how quickly we moved to eugenics, how quickly.
It was faster than we expected. Speaking of moving to eugenics faster than we expected, Ree, if you had to pinpoint a time in history when perhaps the most number of refugees we're moving through hot parts of the world, what would your guess be on where that is? Or when and where?
Where and when?
Maybe the largest movement of refugees in the history of the world.
The largest movement of refugees in the history of the world. You're
jumping
just going to tell me.
Uh-huh. It's the Second World War, right?
Oh, okay, fine. See, I was like, I thought this was a trap.
No, there's no trap.
I was like, it can't be that. Surely he's going to ask me.
Who scarred you? You're like, I'm being trapped.
Academia. I'm like, I don't know. Is he going to ask me about like a fucking Mesopotamia or something? I was like.
The Second World War. I mean, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, really, of refugees moved around, you know. 8 million German refugees alone being moved around over that time period, and there's all parts of the war that none of us even learns about, that we have no idea. Where are these refugees at risk of contracting leishmaniasis? Please, as a Brit, either or both of you, you can tag team this one. Describe for me the Allied invasion of Italy in the Second World War.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, I'll let you take that one, Rhi.
Oh, no, please don't let me take that one. How could you do that to me?
No. You weren't taught about history in a British school system very well?
Well, not like that well. And not that, you know, not that in that depth. And also, I'm a long way out.
You've got a PhD. I did an acting degree.
Hold on a minute. My PhD is about Twitter.
It's not even called Twitter anymore.
Exactly. Helplessly outdated. All right. Wait, what was the question again? I'm stressed.
The Allied invasion of Italy. It was time to invade Europe. And there's two ways to go at it. You can come from Britain and attack under France, or you can come from Africa and you can attack Italy, another country that was in that war on the side of the Axis powers that most people forget because they weren't super effective. They needed to find a good spot to invade, and the island of Sicily was the first and only candidate for place for the Allies to invade in order to control all of the shipping lanes in the Mediterranean so that they could have the proper naval support when they went to actually invade Italy proper. So they've got to deal with disease. And leash money Isis was a really prevalent parasite in Sicily. It's a thing that the Sicilian people have known about for thousands of years because Sicily is an island in the middle of the Mediterranean and has been conquered by literally everyone. The Carthaginians, the Romans, the Persians, the Romans again, the Goths, the, you know, thousands of years of people conquering Sicily. So this parasite's been around for quite a long time. And the U.S. is really worried about it because in 1942, 1943, there were actually 632 cases of leishmaniasis in the U.S. forces. So what did they need to do? How could they hope to take Sicily without facing the demon that is leishmaniasis? Which brings me to my next question, Rhi. How familiar are you with the novel slash movie Dune?
I watched the first one. I haven't watched the second. Mm-hmm. And I read like a decent chunk of it. But yeah, I don't think I finished it. No, I didn't.
I actually watched it last week.
What?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, both films. I watched both last week. So when I saw this in the notes, I was like, oh my God.
Thank God. Yeah. So I live under a rock, so.
You both know who Paul Atreides is then?
I do.
Yeah.
You definitely know who that is.
He's the pretty one. Enough of something completely unrelated.
Is he the one that's Timothée Chalamet? Come on, he's pretty.
He's a baby. He looks like a Victorian boy with consumption.
Yeah.
That's how I like him. Frail.
He's a lot of... Yeah. We said as well, Zendaya in the first film does a lot of like turning around to camera. All she does is just like turn around and do a smoldering look. Like a blue steel to the camera for the whole first film.
That's all I needed.
Which is pretty cool.
So you know that Paul Atreides has like 1,000 nicknames, right?
Yes.
And one of them is the Muad'Dib.
Yep.
Do you remember Muad'Dib? Remember where Muad'Dib comes from?
Is it something about mice? No.
Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the kangaroo mouse of Arrakis. He named himself after these mice in Arrakis, which his, the head of the Fremen is like, ooh, that's a smart play. Mm. They're very, you know... They know the desert.
Yes.
Right? They make their own water and all of these great things. Muad'Dib is based on a real thing. So in 1930, take it a step back, Israel Aroni heard about a creature in the Syrian mountains. And much like Muad'Dib was able to survive in the harshest of conditions, even when faced with disease. Locally known by Syrians as Abu Jarab, which translates into Mr. Saddlebags.
Stop it. That's so cute.
Mr. Saddlebags. That's right. The Syrian hamster. The most popular hamster pet breed in the world, known in Arabic as Abu Jarab, Mr. Saddlebags. Let me tell you that this is the origin story of this episode. This is the fact I found out that then I said, well, now I've got to do an episode about hamsters. So Mr. Saddlebags was like kind of a legend. Like no one had ever captured Mr. Saddlebags before. No one had bred any of them. They were just these things that like guides were like, oh yeah, there's like a mouse that lives in the hills and in the mountains. We call him Mr. Saddlebags. And of course, why is he called Mr. Saddlebags? Hamster shoves stuff in his cheeks, so it looks like he's got saddlebags like on the side of his horse or camel, as the case may be. So this professor named Saul Adler sent Israel Aroni into Syria and said, go find me some Mr. Saddlebags, because he'd been experimenting with Chinese dwarf hamsters for trying to get them to breed and trying to get consistent breeding pairs and to use them as lab animals to test for human medicine and so on and so forth. And they didn't work.
Can I ask about the year we're in? What year are we in now?
1930. This is 1930. We're a full decade before the Second World War. We've taken a step back. So as you may remember, your Russian dwarf hamster was not necessarily the most robust character. If you're willing to share, how did Rasputin leave this world?
He got like a lesion on his eye.
Yep.
And he lived for a little while with it. It was not a we're taking him to the vet situation. He'd already had a couple years on him, and like there was just it wasn't realistic that my parents were gonna pay for that. Like, black family household, you don't do that sort of thing. Yeah, he died like really close to my 16th birthday. When my grandma also died.
Oh no.
So I went to school and like I hadn't like cried about that yet. And then I went, I started crying in geography and I was like, my hamster died and my grandma. And I'll just never forget. It was really weird.
Two on the same sentence.
In the same sentence, I was like, my hamster died and my grandma.
Hamster first.
The first time I cried.
Yeah.
Amazing.
But you know, hamsters, I was going to ask you at the beginning when you said you had a hamster, like how it died, because hamsters are known for having really crazy deaths. Do you not know this?
Yeah.
Like everyone who has a hamster is like, oh yeah, it escaped into some floorboards and I never saw it again. Or like, you know what I mean? They
suicided or something. Like something weird. Yeah.
They all like to die in very crazy ways. And now for something completely unrelated. When it got to the end of my hamster's life, I really felt like it was near the end, but I didn't know when it was coming. And I was having house parties at the time because I was in my early 20s. And every time I was at a house party, people were like, can I see the hamster? And I'd be like, no, it might be dead. And I don't want to discover it's dead at a house party. I did that for a whole year. No, it's probably dead. Yeah, I don't want you to look at it.
I'm so glad you didn't. That didn't happen. How did you find it dead in the end?
It's two behind legs stopped working. And I had to take her to go get put down, and it cost me £80. And I took her in a bucket to IKEA, next to where IKEA was, where the vet was. And I left.
You say IKEA as a service.
Sorry, I'm just, to IKEA for no reason.
Well, the whole thing was made out of IKEA furniture, so maybe there is this full life cycle IKEA hamster service.
It was like right next to the IKEA, the vets. And then I left with an empty bucket. And then my lift wasn't there yet. And so I walked around IKEA with an empty bucket and an empty heart.
So the thing about Mr. Saddlebags, in the wild, they can live for over a decade. Like the Syrian hamster in the wild is a hearty, hearty boy, but no one had ever seen a breeding pair before. So he sends this guy in, 12th of April, 1930, go get me some hamsters. And what I love about this guy, Israel Aroni, who's a researcher for UCL, but he's in Jerusalem. He's set up in Jerusalem. He like hires a bunch of guides and heads into the mountains, and they're all like, you want Mr. Saddlebags? All right. I mean, I think we know where he is. But finally, he found a nest with 10 baby hamsters that he took back to his lab in Jerusalem to begin breeding. It will surprise neither of you that within 8 hours, 5 of the hamsters chewed out of the wooden box and escaped into the wild.
Of course, yeah.
Immediately, 50% of them gone.
My hamster chewed out of the box on the way back from buying it, and it was just loose in the car. It was really stressful.
Got a loose hamster. Then of the remaining 5, 4 female hamsters, 1 male. The next day, the male ate one of the females.
At least it was that way around. Sorry, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If they ate the last male, I'm like, well, that didn't work out. And, like, this guy, this Aroni guy, he could not, for the life of him, keep these goddamn hamsters alive. It came down to the last 2. 1 male and 1 female finally bred in the summer of 1930, having a litter, and the 2 of them would go on to create 150 baby hamsters over the course of their lives. Here's a fun fact. 2 fun facts in a row. Fun fact number 1, they were siblings. Fun fact number 2, every golden hamster, including Pesto, in this world that is domesticated, descends from those 2 siblings breeding. All golden hamsters are the products of Israel Aroni's really botched, shitty breeding of sibling hamsters.
I don't feel great about that. I feel like, has that caused any hamster issues? Or
it has 100% caused hamster issues. Like I said, in the wild, Mr. Saddlebags is a tough, robust, becomes aged, spreads the wisdom to the next generation about how to survive the desert. But as you've both noted, the domestic hamster, significantly less robust. Because they are all inbred, all golden hamsters actually have very weak hearts. Their hearts are not as robust as they're meant to be. Their lifespan is significantly shorter than their wild cousins. This is consistent with pretty much all domesticated creatures except for cats. Cats are because we don't control them. But yes, all golden hamsters, all Syrian hamsters are basically the pugs of the hamster world, an abomination that has got its life cut short. But interestingly enough, because of that weakness, Syrian hamsters experience heart failure and heart disease at almost the exact same rate as humans. So normally they have very robust cardiovascular systems, but because of this inbreeding, they've got weak hearts just like us. Fun fact about humans, in case the listener at home doesn't know, or Ree or Nami, our hearts are terrible. They're not designed for this 70 to 100 year bullshit that we play. That's why heart disease is the number one killer of humans, flat out, followed usually by things like cancer. So, 1930, by the end of 1931, we've got these breedable, 150 breedable hamsters. Now, fast forward to 1940. A man named Leonard Goodwin was out of a job. So Goodwin signed up to join the Royal Tank Regiment, and he was so bad at tank operation that they sent him back to London to do research at a little place down in Euston we now call the Wellcome Trust.
Oh, my fave!
Yeah, the Wellcome Trust. This is when the Wellcome Trust becomes the Wellcome Trust. It was actually different things. But during World War II, they got, you know, brought together, and the Wellcome Trust, for those not in the know, is an organization that does research on medicine and also on culture. It's where a lot of the funding I can ever find on the health benefits of history and heritage are all sort of housed in the Wellcome Trust, and has a good museum right there across the street from Euston train station. Worth checking out. So Goodwin was hired to do research on tropical diseases, and specifically, he was hired to figure out what can treat leishmaniasis. He was the man put in charge of the parasite. So for a year and some change, he tries experimenting with rats, mice, guinea pigs, you name it. And he kills probably like 600 or 700 of these creatures. It's sad because they all already had a resistance to the parasite. So when he would try to dose them to treat them for the parasite, he would end up just giving them too much because it didn't make sense. It wasn't none of the numbers were calculating up for him. So he rings up Israel Aroni and he says, "Get me some saddlebags. I want some Mr. Saddlebags for my research." So, Mr. Saddlebags, no natural resistance to the parasite. So what Goodwin does is he's going to dose them with a chemical that he believes will be effective in treating the parasite. But he wants to give it enough to kill the parasite, but not too much to poison the host. He's looking for the chemotherapeutic index, right? That's what we call that. That's why we call chemotherapy chemotherapy, because we are trying to give you enough poison to kill the cancer, but not so much poison that you die, which is why chemotherapy is rough. You are purposely poisoning yourself. So after not that long, like shockingly, he kind of nails this in about 6 months, he figures out the chemotherapeutic index for pentastam in humans by experimenting on Mr. Saddlebag hamsters. And he sends it off to the Allies, who stock up on pentastam in anticipation of their campaign into Sicily. Hilariously, maybe 6 doses, maybe 12 doses were ever used, because they also packed mosquito nets. Not that many people got infected.
Maybe they shouldn't have killed all those rodents, you know?
It's like a thousand animals had to die for this guy to figure this out. Meanwhile,
just use the nets.
They're like, "Hey guys, your cots need to be a meter high, and here's some mosquito nets that we just dunked with DDT." DDT. It was DDT at them, which I'm sure gave so many soldiers cancer anyway. But World War II. So. The thing about, as we said, the golden hamster is they can start breeding at 5 weeks and they can have 5 litters of 13 hamsters in a year. That is a thing they can manage. Goodwin, it turns out, unlike Israel, was really good at breeding hamsters. I don't know what that says about Goodwin, but after sending off this, you know, this chemotherapeutic index to the army, he just had tons of hamsters left over. Now, protocol, for those of you not familiar, when dealing with research specimens, as they would be referred to in the lab, is once you're done, you tend to euthanize them. That's a very common practice, especially in 1943. But as we have already noted, the hamster, the golden hamster, is too cute. He's too cute. You can't, come on. You can't euthanize Mr. Saddlebags. That's no good.
Especially if that's his name. God.
I know. So for a period of 6 months, Goodwin would smuggle several hamsters out of the lab in his pockets, just in his lab coat pockets. And he would walk from the Wellcome Trust to King's Cross, where he would catch his tube train to go home, and he would just hand them to children on the streets. The most insane thing I've ever heard. Just imagine you're walking down the street, and a man, a well-dressed man, you know, works for Wellcome Trust, he's not poor, he just doesn't say anything, pulls a hamster out of his coat pocket, and then hands it to you as a child. Yes.
So one, no stranger danger. We're just accepting rodents from people's pockets.
Correct.
Fine. Yes, fine. 1940s London. Yeah, cool. But also, like, the people the children he's handing them to are the children who were not evacuated in the Blitz. So it's like,
correct,
what, like little poor children running about with hamsters?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It was poor children. And in fact, that's a great point to make, because the hamster was the perfect pet for wartime London, because they're so inexpensive.
Yeah.
Dogs, cats, too big.
Mm.
They're really expensive to feed, especially during rationing. Especially cats, because cats are carnivorous.
Mm-hmm.
They got to eat meat. And meat was like the most rationed thing. Hamsters eat scraps. They eat seeds. They eat each other. Like, they'll eat anything. Like, hamsters do not care. And when the air siren would go off, when you needed to get to the shelter, dog or cat, you got to wrangle them. The dog's freaking out because of the sound. Cat is a cat. You can't wrangle cats. That's actually a thing we say. It's like, right? It's
like herding cats.
Hamster, pick it up, put it in your pocket. Boom. You're on your way to the shelter immediately. No thoughts. And then probably that hamster would crawl out of your pocket and then wander around the tube. And I'm sure there are, like, mutant hamsters living underneath London.
It would chew its way out and bite you. That's what they do.
Okay. So by 1940, this guy's for 6 months. So 1943, he's handing out hamsters. By 1949, hamsters become so popular as a pet that, and this is a real thing, the National Hamster Council was established in the United Kingdom, an organization which remains to this day.
Mm.
It is the official council of hamster pet ownership in the United Kingdom.
Naomi, you the chair.
Literally, slay. I'm like, oh, I probably spent hours on that website.
I'm so glad. What's great for the audience is to know, like, I send all the notes to Naomi ahead of time so that she can make sure it makes sense. Because sometimes, you'll be surprised to know, I don't make any sense.
I was so gassed about this episode. Well, I think my response was, no notes, I love it. I want to talk about hamsters.
Hamster episode.
I was nerding out. When you nerd out about comic books, this was my nerdy episode. I was like, hamsters.
Absolutely. I love that. So yes, Naomi's future employer, the National Hamster Council, and its compatriots, both in the United States and Canada, are responsible for the publication of advertisements and, like, guides all about the adoption of hamsters as pets, and apparently the YouTube videos that teach you about how to take care of them.
Hmm.
Everything you know about, like, having a hamster as a pet stems from this organization. Food pellets, that was their idea. Mm. Lining the cage with, like, sawdust and wood chips so that they had something to burrow into, hamster council. That was actually their way of sort of dealing with, because obviously, as we've said on the show a million times, rationing continues until 1953. So, like, just having sawdust and wood chips was just something cheap that you could ensure the cage was a little more sanitary.
Mm.
So they weren't just, like, swimming in their own pee all the time. The concept of having a hamster as a pet starts here. No one kept hamsters as pets before the 1940s. So everyone in the world who has a pet hamster can thank Mr. Goodwin and his unwillingness to euthanize his lab specimens and instead hand them out to random strangers on the streets of London.
I'm just, like, picturing how that goes down. Like, hey, kid, you want this rodent from my pocket? And they're like, yes, that's adorable, sure. Like, what? Like,
and hamsters are so hard to carry. Like, hamsters hate being carried. And the fact that, like, He just handed them out on the streets. It's very impressive.
Yeah. What's really frustrating is in his obituary, where this is mentioned, and also in a Telegraph article talking about him, which, again, you go to the show notes, you can see the links to that, where these stories are confirmed. No one describes it. No one says, like, oh, you know, he would just carry around and sort of play with it. Maybe a kid would be curious, and then he'd hand it to the kid. No. So I am left, like you, to just go, what is he just, like, see a kid pulling out of his pocket and go, here you go, kid. And just, like, toss him a hamster. Have a hamster. Like, what the hell are we talking about? This guy, how is he handing out hamsters on the streets?
Also, they're not common enough, so he's going to have to explain what it is. Hey, child, this is a hamster.
Yeah.
And, like, also, how are they breeding after this as well? He must be giving some people too.
Yeah. Now, let's get a little wild with it. Imagine you're a kid, right? Because he's doing this for a period of 6 months. One day, a strange man on Euston Road hands you a hamster. You take it home. You're like, this hamster rules.
Mm.
You're going to go back to Euston Road, right? You're going to hang around and be like, does that guy got to come back?
I'm getting 10 hamsters.
Yeah. It's going to become hamster-palooza. You're going to overrun your house with hamsters. And maybe you take some of those hamsters and you sell them to somebody. Now you got a side buzz. It's a hustle now. This is how you got to live.
And this is like 100% with certainty where it starts. That's crazy.
I've looked into competing theories.
Mm.
There's a bunch of different stories that are like, no, it was this guy in a lab, but there's no supporting evidence. This is the only story in which I can get multiple sources confirming, including a child who received a hamster, who said it in like a National Hamster Council thing or whatever in the 60s or something. So it is confirmed that definitely this guy handed out like 100 hamsters. And since we don't have any data to suggest where the rest of them came from that can be confirmed, it seems like these hamsters, which again, I want to remind you, are descended from two siblings from 10 years before he started breeding these bad boys, all who were two siblings who bred after the brother ate one of the other sisters. Hamsters are nuts.
Really metal. Okay, I'm also interested in like the kind of like the cultural turn that had to have happened for this to happen, you know? Yeah. Because even just like, I'm thinking about this in terms of some cultures that just don't really keep pets, right?
Yeah.
Like in the Caribbean, like a dog is not a thing that lives in your house, is something right. that lives in the garden in a little crate or something, right? Like people don't have that kind of emotional attachment to dogs, and there's lots of places like that. At what point, because like at some point during, like, and then you can think about it the same way as what happens to like pigeons that were like, oh, beloved pets, carrier pigeons, lovely. And now they're like, oh, get it away from me. So like the cultural association that changes this thing from lab animal to beloved house pet, or even just like rodent, that is like, you know, we don't feel good about rodents in our home generally. Like, are people keeping rats at this time? Are people keeping mice? Or is this like the beginning of us being like, hey, rodent, maybe a pet? That's such a quick time frame for that change to happen, too.
The interesting thing is rats, as commercial pets, very, very common until the 19-teens. I think World War I is really when that shifts. And that's because, and this show always takes a dark turn, Ree, just so you know. It always takes a dark turn. Rats for the purposes of rat fighting.
Oh.
So, like, rat fighting was super, duper common in Britain and in the colonies in North America especially, until the 20th century. Like, so common. It's outrageous. Like, this is a fun fact, before football here in Britain and became, like, an official federated thing, and rugby and cricket, and before baseball became a thing in the U.S., rat fighting was the most popular sport in both Britain and the United States.
How bizarre.
Hands down. People loved betting on rats fighting. So, yes. And then, as you said, pigeons were like bred by middle class and upper class people, and they would have pigeon shows. And then one day people were like, "Hey, we're kind of done with this," and they just let the pigeons go. And so every pigeon that poops on you in public descends from royalty, is how I like to think of the pigeon. And the difference between a dove and a pigeon is that one of them looks cleaner than the other, according to humans. So it colorism. Wouldn't have been outrageous to have kept a rodent as a pet. No, it wouldn't have been weird at all to keep rodents as pets. Mm. But this is the first time the hamster enters into Britain. It, you know, it's from Syria, and no one had kept them as pets or kept them even as lab specimens until 1930. So yeah, this is just, it wouldn't have been weird to have rodents as pets. Hamsters are less.
They're cuter than rats.
They're cuter than rats. They're smaller
they
than
rats.
They
use their hands to eat.
And they do. They have their hands. And they have the cheeks. So all of this is saying, the hamster becomes a pet because when we tried to invade Sicily in the Second World War, we were worried about Leishmaniasis as a parasite, and Mr. Saddlebags was the best candidate to test a treatment for it, which led to a crazy man walking around the streets of London handing out hamsters. So while, like, we can therefore say that war has given us this treat, this joy, this little creature that eats with its hands and stuffs its cheeks with deliciosity, we say that all the time, right? We always say that, like, war is where so many inventions come out, because necessity is, quote, the mother of invention. But hamsters are not necessary. There's nothing necessary about hamsters. People think that there's some weird thought process behind anything. Like, oh yeah, hamsters became pets maybe because they were useful, and then once their usefulness was no longer around, we just kept them. Like there's a lot of pets that fulfill that. Like the pigeons could send messages, and then once they stop sending messages, you keep them as pets. But no, actually, war is just a weird time for humans where the rules go out the window and we dedicate all our resources to trying to, like, actively solve problems instead of creating problems, or, I don't know, building tension between the classes or the races or the genders in order to uphold the status quo. But during wartime, that stuff goes away. And, like, sometimes things happen because when we do that, we accidentally discover that Mr. Saddlebags is fucking adorable. And we should have that guy in our lives. We should have Mr. Saddlebags not in an empty bucket, not in an empty heart, but in a full heart that doesn't have parasites in it. So, Ree, what did you learn today?
Oh my goodness, like, quite a lot. I more than I thought I would, tell you that.
Did you see where it was going?
I think I did from the bit of insects. Sorry, parasite. I kind of thought, okay, this is going to be something where, like, the hamster's got a natural immunity or something. I was wrong, but, like, that was, you know, like, I thought, oh,
you
this
were in
is
the neighborhood.
I was in the neighborhood. I did not expect, like, there is just no way I could have imagined a man walking down Euston Road with hamsters in his lab coat pockets. I think the lab coat pocket part is the most charming bit of all of that. And no, I just didn't see that coming, I got to say. Like, there's a lot of, like, weird war stuff, you know? Like, I feel like a lot of what happens in that time period is really off, so I'm like, yeah, okay, par for the course, fine, glad to know this little extra nugget of, like, insane shit happening. But my I guess my favorite fact out of it all, well, yeah, learned that I knew less about World War II than you would expect. But yeah, I guess best bit was me having, like, realizing that I like that hamsters hate each other.
I love that.
Thank you.
And you know what? Maybe it's because they became pets at a time of war.
That's true. Maybe there was something. Maybe those siblings really hated each other, like, a lot.
Well, if your brother ate your sister in and front then of bred you. With you.
Come on, man.
You'd have beef.
There's problems.
Epigenetics. Look it up.
And Andrew, is there anything that you would like to tell the listener about the researching of this episode?
Well, thank you for asking. So we on this show are always warning people to be wary of the claims made, pretty much all claims made, by an organization which can benefit from said claims, especially financially, right? We're fighting misinformation here. So, like all the hamster councils of the world and other hamster enthusiasts have origin stories for the pet hamster, as I said, that don't have much in the way of supporting evidence. They just seem to be a story that someone, maybe a founding member or something, has just said, and everyone sort of taken it as the truth. So when I was writing this episode, I got to the end bit where I was like, the lab happened, and then Goodwin just, he handed out some hamsters. The end. And I didn't mention anything about hamster councils or anything like that, because I thought that was just an end. And that was not good. That was too short of an ending. We needed this more exploration, which Ree was really helpful in as well. So I went back to those sources, which I had deemed useless on sussing out the origin story, to read up on what they were selling people. So that's where I found out about sawdust in cages, because that's what they were trying to sell, right? They were trying to sell people food pellets and sawdust for the cages. And I can then see that really matches up with things like rationing on a lot of what you would have used to keep a cage clean previously, for bird cages especially. And you can go, oh, cool. So when we're dismissing sources for being invalid, for not serving our needs, don't throw them away. Keep those sources lying around, because there's a chance you will still find something interesting down the road that's going to help you really explore your topic with even more depth. So that's my little tip for folks at home doing their research. So the end of the show has arrived. Ree, please, thank you for coming on the show. It's been a joy. We've had so much fun.
Yeah.
Tell the people. Tell them where, if they want to find you, if they want to purchase your book, perhaps. Ooh. Where can they do this? How can they connect with you in the world?
Oh my goodness. Harder than ever these days. I got my socials on lockdown. But I have a website, and I will eventually even update it. So if you happen to find me through this, do shoot me a message through my contact form. It's literally riannawalcott.com. So super duper easy. Other than that, the book Technoskepticism is available through, it's published by Stanford University Press and combined academic publishers in the, distribute it in the UK. So you'll find it. It can be found.
You could also pick up, even though it won't quite look like this, The Color of Madness, Exploring BAME Mental Health in the UK. I have a original first edition, hot off the press.
OG edition, that's right.
2019?
Was it 2018 even, maybe, that first one?
Oh my God, it might be 2018.
Can
you're
you
right.
believe it? Oh my Good God, I'm Lord. Old.
I was going to say, we're getting old. Well,
the most recent paperback came out, our renewed, the expanded edition was, I want to say, last summer. So yeah, you can find that, Pam Macmillan, blah, blah. Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you. And you can find us, Seemingly Unrelated Podcast, on the podcast app of your choice. Maybe it's Apple, maybe it's Spotify, maybe it's Pocket Cast, maybe it's Overcast. I don't know. But you can find it there everywhere for free. But if you want to support us, if you want to help us out, we've got a Patreon. We do a bonus episode every month. We've done a bonus episode recently about Donkey Kong, and it turns out that Naomi, A, likes Nintendo, and B, didn't qualify for a mortgage application, which is
two seemingly unrelated things.
Two seemingly unrelated things, and all topped off with liquid ham. You want to find out what that means? You go to patreon.com/seemingly unrelated for just $2 a month. You can find out that and so much more because we've got, I mean, gosh, we're up to 10. We're up to 10 bonus episodes now. $2, 10 episodes. It's a bargain.
Stay
again, that's patreon.com/seemingly unrelated. This is all we have for this week. Us and Mr. Saddlebags are going to ride off into, I guess, the Syrian desert, which doesn't sound like a safe idea at the moment, but we're going to do it anyway. And we will be back in just 2 short, sweet weeks with more seemingly unrelated madness. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone, audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Cohn. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seeminglyunrelatedpod.com. Let's go back to what you definitely know. What do the Allies do to defeat Hitler in the Second World War? Either of you. What's the story that you were told as kids?
I know that he... I feel like we're being tricked. I know I'm being trapped.
It's very complicated.
But I don't know, man.
You've made a spiral.
No, this is great because this is why the show exists. The history education on this is absolutely terrible. I just, neither of you, by the way,
D-Day?
Naomi,
Normandy?
There you go. Hey, oh, D-Day.
Thank God. I literally completely forgot.
Oh my goodness.